You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
I don't know which Shabin she was hanging out at last night, the morning after. We're hanging out with this incredible novelist, Rahana Rousseau. She was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and that was just before the release of her new novel, New Times. And this is the second novel, of course, her first novel, What Will People Say, have done incredibly well to much-deserved critical acclaim. And the second novel has not disappointed either. She is on holiday, but she's made time for us, and I really hope that this one will get the same kind of love from you as a book buyer, as a reader. Rahana, thank you so much for popping in again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Dragging you out of holiday.
It's fine.
First and foremost, geluk.
Thank you.
And a similar question I got to ask you as I put to Riri Klabi, because she had a similar problem as you. The first book, when it is such an enormous success, how hard is it to get yourself to let go of your second baby? Because you are so mindful. You have to be, even if you are humble about your craft, you have to be aware, at least privately and in front of your BFFs, that the first book did so well that it must be difficult to let go of the second one. What will people say about New Times?
I found the first book much, much more difficult than the second book. Yes, I did. The second book, I think I had a clearer idea in my head what I wanted to achieve. I stumbled a lot along the way. I wrote it at a difficult time. Mm. My father passed away. I had an aunt who passed away. But the book was my salvation. It kept me going. So.
And you've said so in some of the other interviews as well, a form of release, a form of escapism, therapeutic, all the classic things that writing gives us. We don't make money from it, but at least we keep our fragile sanity intact. Shall we describe for the listeners, very basically, we're not going to give much away because they must go buy the book this afternoon at Exclusives, but the central character is absolutely fascinating. Introduce the public to Ali, in case they don't know her.
So Ali Adams is a young political reporter in 1995. She has just lost the start. She's starting a new job after being unemployed for 4 months, and unemployment really, really, really hurt her self-esteem badly. She is the breadwinner in her household. She lives with her grandmother and her mother. And she's trying to get back on her feet as a political reporter, just at the time that there are a lot of changes in Nelson Mandela's government as he enters his second term as president of South Africa. At work, she's Ali Adams. At home, she's Aliya. At home, she's a good Muslim woman. She wears a scarf. She covers her head in front of men, especially. Mm. Her family's quite religious, and she herself finds a lot of comfort from the religion and from her culture.
What do you depict so wonderfully, accurately, and vividly is the mood within journalism, but also within the country at that particular time, right? So you find yourself in newsrooms, I'm not sure how much more they've changed, where you have all these different characters. And every journalist must read this book, but I think the characters are so well written, you don't need to be a journalist to appreciate it. But it becomes most recognizable to us who've been in some of these newsrooms. I could see some characters that both you and I know in the real world that actually resemble some of the characters in the book. But it's fascinating because everyone is trying to come to grips with their place in the newsroom, kind of like in society. Just talk me through that and why it was important for you and why you wanted to tease that out. Like the battles between Ali and, you know, and more senior journalists than the New Times. And, I mean, obviously, you write it so well that it seems to be just a clash of personalities, then the one gets cliffed out of the building. But the truth of the matter is there's also a subtext to this stuff going on. It is also about, in society at large, how we are all fighting for different new forms of visibility that we didn't have before. But it wasn't easy to get it. You had to fight for that space.
Yes, and particularly with Nelson Mandela. We all wanted him to succeed. We all believed that he was building a rainbow nation, and we were all coming together, and, you know, especially in terms of culture and race, that we all had a common vision. And I didn't intend to write a book about 6 weeks in 1995, but it turned out to be a book, because 6 weeks was enough. to show that break between people who thought that we were truly a rainbow nation and people who realized, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Nelson Mandela is selling, you know, fake medicine. And we're not as united as we think we are. There are still deep fractures in society. And yeah, the ANC is not necessarily the best political organization to deliver the promise of freedom. So
absolutely.
I wanted that. I think those 6 weeks in 95 shows clearly some of the early flaws in the ANC, which led us to the place we are today.
Now, one of the things you achieve wonderfully in the book is the different worlds that Ali has to inhabit. And, you know, when we first started reflecting, this is my manuscript that never got published. I remember I even had the title Schizophrenia in it. But it's not, it's not the right word to use. As human beings, we have incredible range, don't we? You can have your old white colleagues who's got post-traumatic stress syndrome that you deal with in the newsroom. You can have your own as a colored woman or a brown woman. You can have a comrade who is phenotypically black African from the ANC days who are now working within the state. And then you still have to go back to your own Muslim community in the Boer Kaap. And it's not so much that you are wearing masks. It's just different parts of yourself, isn't it?
Yes, I think that is what one needs to do in order to become a true, sorry to use a cliche, rainbow citizen. You need to be able to move between different worlds in South Africa. Yeah. And it's difficult. It's hard. So Ali's dearest friend, Lizo, is accepted in her Malay household in Boer Kaap as a son of the family. And is accepted as a son of the family because when he was imprisoned on Robben Island, his cellmate was an imam, a Muslim man. And he learnt the religion and he learnt the culture and he fits in.
That surprised me. You come from Cape Town. I'm not from there. How typical was that kind of acceptance? Because the first time Lizo goes home to the Boer Kaap, you know, in a long time, and he eats with the family, etc., I thought to myself, the rapport between him, the mom, and the grandmother is almost—it's almost too smooth. And I know on some mense kan baie racisties wees.
Yes. Did I pull it off?
No, you did pull it off. But I was wondering whether there are parts of the politics, particularly of brown people, as it were, that has a complexity that was important for you to lift to the surface. Because when I think about my colored family, I think about a bunch of people who fundamentally, most of them, I have to be honest, with very few exceptions, have got very odious attitudes towards black people.
Yeah, but Ali's family has some politics.
Sure.
And therefore, I thought I could get away with it, and I brought him home.
Yeah. Now, many of us who loved the first novel, you will wonder, are there continuities, discontinuities? I think there are some incredibly powerful and at times very melancholic continuities. There's also, as some reviewers have rightly recognized, and one of my favorite reviews was from Timon Smith, that the way, the minutiae, the cultural nuances, the way both in the inflection of language but also the descriptions of place that Rahana introduces us to the Boer Kaap is absolutely amazing. And that for me is one stylistic similarity and also as a storyteller, one continuity with the first novel as well. But I'm going to ask her to read and then we'll take a break, Danao, don't worry. And this is randomly on page 72 of the novel, but it is a little bit of a depiction of Sunday lunch and a Boer Kaap. And we just love her reading voice. That's actually why I wanted her to read.
Thank you. Sunday lunch in Boer Kaap has to be a rice dish, followed by pudding. Mummy prefers her people's biryani to the akni that the Malays favor. Big Mummy thinks biryani is too complicated and perfumed for everyday food. We should only have it for special occasions like Eid. It's going to be hard to figure out whose favorite dish I was aiming for when I serve up my low-budget variation. I plant Mummy and Big Mummy in the lounges in the yard, one with the Sunday paper and one fingering a tusby. The wind is fussing in the tallest branches of the fig tree, but the high walls shelter the yard from the worst of its bluster. I instruct my women to soak up the sunshine and store it away for the winter. Radio Lotus keeps me company in the kitchen. The latest Bollywood hits send my hips swinging as I stand at the counter next to the sink and peel and chop and slice and dice. I'm finally getting my head around vegetarian cooking. 3 weeks before I'm back on my feet. Why did I think the poor white people we passed on the way to the Air Force base were stupid? When you're short on money, you have to calculate every expense while keeping track of all the costs coming your way. You have to find new ways of doing almost everything, and you have to keep your health and your spirits up with little resources. Sacrificing things is a whole lot easier than finding a new way to make the essentials of life possible with very little resources. Life can't be sustained without stress on a limited income if you are a slow learner.
Oh, I love you, darling. You make it seem so easy. 19 minutes after 11.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
We're talking about New Times, the second novel by Rahana Rousseau, and it's absolutely beautiful. Rahana, I don't know whether I was meant to be sad or not, but I mean, you have a way, your characters are, both in this novel and your first novel, they make you laugh your behind off, and at the same time, this tinges of melancholy, right? And because I, as you know, live the examined life like you, I kind of like characters that have that kind of complexity and even psychosis that they have to deal with. So can we talk about another sub-theme in the book? And I can't believe we only have 7 minutes left. So really, we're just giving snippets away to the readers, which is Demophis. And I mean, you know, angels and your description of it, and another one of Ellie's many overlapping circles of human beings that she has to inhabit as friends. There was a part of me that had obvious nostalgia because the very first gay club I went to was actually Angels. I tried to get into Bronx. I was bounced. I think I must have looked too straight or too scruffy. So I went next door. And Cher was playing and Belief. So on the one hand, I found myself smiling at the recognition of gay Cape Town. And on the other hand, there's also this weird, weird, weird sense of just sadness at the fact that gay people and the characters in your novel, I think, bear this out, are simultaneously resilient but also incredibly, incredibly vulnerable.
Yes. So I have gay characters in my novel. It's a big theme because I'm examining Nelson Mandela's presidency, and AIDS was one of his big failings and one of the few that he apologized for. And in 1995, in the 6 weeks that my novel takes place, AIDS is at that stage killing people in the gay community. It is spreading into the heterosexual community, but it's a huge problem for a gay community, which is why I had to have a gay character, and we had to look at AIDS through the lens of people who were mostly affected at that stage. But they live. They're dying, but while they're dying, they live.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's double-edged, right? Because it's a celebration. It's a little bit what I was trying to get to in the previous hour, when I don't think I made the point very well with Charlene in relation to Shabin Queens, is that there's a kind of like incredible zest for life that comes with being on the margins that gay people always had, and without romanticizing the incredible lives that we had to carve out for ourselves when homosexuality was even more frowned upon, both in terms of the law and socially, than it is now, 20, 30 years ago. There's also, let's be honest, and you find something similar with some of the gay characters in the second novel of Sello Dacre, The Quiet Violence of Dreams. I mean, we live on Eerste Tate.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
It's amazing. And I think you bring that out very, very vividly. Why was that very important for you to do, other than the HIV/AIDS issue? Because there's also obviously all sorts of identity and other journeys that one goes through in relation to a non-heteronormative identity.
Again, because Ali is at home, at least the practicing Muslim, I could use the gay issue to bring out some of the issues in the community. I mean, gay men are quite acceptable. Everybody knows a Mofi in Bulkap. Everybody probably has a Mofi in the family in Bulkap, but he's likely to be a boy.
Yeah.
There ain't much space for girls who like girls. Mm. In fact, while I was writing the book, I was checking with, you know, all my friends in Cape Town. How many gay women do they know living in Bulkap? Because Bulkap has, sadly, I think, in the new South Africa, become the gay community.
Mm.
Lots of the houses are being bought up at ridiculous prices by gay people from other places in the world.
Yeah.
The first gay B&B in the entire country, on this entire continent, was in this conservative Muslim community, which is fascinating. Mm. So while there may be acceptance for gay, there certainly ain't acceptance for gay girls still today.
Absolutely. Two final things I want to explore with you because we only have 3 minutes left. The state, right? There was such an obsession with the hope motif that we had to learn things as we go along. And I really enjoyed how you explored the fact that many of us, unless you had a really clever friend that maybe went to UCT or a Marxist economics professor, especially as journalists, we kind of had to sort of very quickly click on Internet Explorer and get with the program and learn a new vocabulary, just as within the state, the politicians had to quickly come to terms with, oh gosh, what does it now mean to be in the driving seat of power? And it was not a very deliberative path the morning after political freedom was won, and it seemed to me that one of the things you clearly wanted to explore and achieved very well was how incredibly ad hoc many of our lives suddenly became.
Yes. I mean, the ANC came to power with the Harare Declaration that spoke about nationalizing the commanding heights of the economy. The ANC came to power with the RDP, it spoke about empowering the poor. Spending was going to be mostly directed to poor people. Hmm. And then took the sudden turn in 1995, without explanation, really, to the entire country. Hmm. And I found myself at the time, that's true for me as a political reporter, I knew all the language of liberation. I knew nothing about tax deficits. Mm. I knew nothing about, you know, well, I still struggle with some of those economic terms. And suddenly in 1995...
But like Ali, we learn how to say the right sentences in the newsroom.
We do. And we hope we don't get our stories wrong.
Rohana, individuals and the country suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. We often see the symptoms. Do you think that we have dealt with it? Do you think we ever will? I know for you, one of the ways to deal with this is through your writing. But it seems to me like one of those conversations we don't have often enough. We just don't know what to do about it.
This book, when I sat down to write the opening sentence, was in response to the Fallists. The Fallists debating the use of violence and then the Fallists defending the use of violence. Now, myself personally, anybody who burns libraries is never going to be my friend. Mm. Like, burn books and I don't want to know you. Mm. But then I started, besides that kind of anger, I started thinking, no, we fought so that you don't have to fight. We fought and our fighting had terrible consequences for us. I know so many comrades who are crippled today by the violence they experienced. Mm. And no, we fought so that you could have the right to protest without burning things and without being arrested and held for months without bail, as happened with the Fallists. I don't want the next generation of South Africans to go what we went through.
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Sure. Well, congratulations. I'm not going to ask you about your next novel, for not just because it's irritating, but for a very important reason, which is that the first two novels that she has written, What Will People Say and New Times, are so important that I always get suspicious of people who say to me, when is your book on Sela Dekker coming out? Because I want to secretly say to them, have you read my other three yet? Right? So let's actually, as a country, we need to discuss Rohana's work much more. If I was my NG, for example, I would agitate with those that I have some political control over to make especially her first novel compulsory reading for matriculants. So this is a book that still needs to travel. It needs to be read widely. Buy it as a gift to yourself or to a friend, and also the first novel as well. An incredible achievement. Thank you so much for hanging out with us, Rohana.
Thank you, Eusebio.